Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. This is Al Warren here, and Eric Shapiro, of course, from the San Francisco Bay section, is on the co-host line.
How are you doing, Al?
I'm always good.
Good.
Always.
Always. Well, you know, even when I'm not, I'm good,
yeah,
right?
Sounds accurate.
Yeah. We've got a guest here for an interview, and she's award-winning. And the book is called The Second Coming of the KKK, and it's the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s and the American political tradition. Boy, that's a mouthful. Linda Gordon, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for your interest.
Yeah. Geez, like, first of all, this is a very touchy subject. There's so much been going on in the U.S. this last couple of years, actually since Trump, I guess, since nationalism and racism and
right,
all of this stuff going on. Is that what drew you into writing this book? Is that what made you actually put this research and book out?
Yes and no. This was actually originally a chapter in a longer book. But it is true that when Trump happened and we started to see the increase in these white nationalist groups, my agent and my editor said, look, why don't you expand this and turn it into a book? That was not my intention, but I did that. Although, you know, if you read the book, I am a historian. I don't think I even mentioned anything about our contemporary situation, although I suspect that many readers would see connections without my having to tell them.
Well, it's a constant. I think people don't realize how this is going on all the time. Like, the KKK is there and always has been. And they just have ebbs and flows, right? They go up and they go down. They get more power and then they lose power, and it goes different ways. So this is really not something that just comes out of nowhere.
Right, although the differences between the different, should we say, rebirths of the Klan are very different. We actually speak of there being four Ku Klux Klans. The first, which is the most familiar, is the secret terror group that emerged right after the Civil War. It was extremely violent, responsible for more than 4,000 lynchings. The the 1920s Klan that I wrote about is different in a number of ways, but one of the main things is, first of all, it wasn't secret at all, and it had somewhere between 3 and 5 million members.
Wow.
Then, just very quickly, what historians think of as the third Klan arose during the Civil Rights Movement, particularly in opposition to desegregation of the schools. But as often happens, we might say that the Klanish spirit was really being embodied by a group that called itself the White Citizens Council. And then the fourth Klan is alive today, but it is now just one small group among many, many, many small white nationalist groups.
What's the biggest difference between them? Like, do they all, and I mean this in the sense of, do they all have the same common enemy, or is there differences?
I think there are some enemies in common and some aren't, and that in itself is a very interesting history. Of course, the first Klan targeted exclusively African Americans, and it's avowed purpose was to maintain white supremacy. What the second Klan did was not, they did not surrender one iota of their hostility to black people, but they added two new targets, Jews and Catholics. And for that reason, I often call it bigotry, because some people see that as kind of religious prejudice rather than racial prejudice. But I think there's a motivation that is very, very common to all of these, and that is that there's a way that people who belong to groups that have been dominant do a lot of fear-mongering and try to make people frightened that these aliens, whoever they happen to be, are really going to do something terrible to this country, that they're going to take it over. So in that sense, I think there is a through line, a stream of commonness among all four of the clans.
What do you think the motive is? Like you're saying, in terms of the fear-mongering, you just explained it in the sense of how they get their followers whipped up. But what do you, as you interpret this history, what are you tracking as the sincere motive? Like, what do you think is driving them?
Well, you know, you might want to ask a psychologist about that.
Okay.
I have no insight into people's psychologies, but, you know, I do think, unfortunately, that we have so much evidence in so many parts of the world and so many times about how easy it is to rev up fear and hatred of people who seem different. Now, sometimes there is a real material incentive, right? You can certainly understand about the first Klan that their purpose was to maintain African Americans in their sort of impoverished, helpless state, even though they had just been theoretically freed from slavery. And so there was a huge economic interest in maintaining a low-wage labor force. It's hard to see that in many, many other areas, but I think we have to think that people are not only interested, it's not only a question of profit and money, it's a question of status. And I think people can get to feel very, very threatened when somehow they feel that their status is being challenged. And I think that's really what happened. What started the second Klan really was the massive wave of immigration that came into this country, which starting in about the 1880s up through 1920. And the sense that these people were going to somehow take away the essence of what made them proud to be Americans.
Mm. What do you what's going on with the masks? Does the current incarnation of the Klan still do that? Do they still mask?
Oh, I don't know that. I don't know. I'm really not expert at this. you know, this current iteration. Okay. There is one, there's one continuity, though, and it, let me tell you about it in terms of a remarkable change. The second Klan added to blacks, Jews, and Catholics as their targets, and they made all sorts of conspiracy theories about what these people were doing. They claimed that Jews and Catholics could never be patriotic Americans. But what has happened, and it happened actually rather quickly, is that the anti-Catholicism has more or less disappeared. Not totally right away. I can tell you that in 1960, when John Kennedy was running for president, there were some anti-Catholic attacks on him. Again, the same thing. He's loyal to the Pope, therefore he can't be a good American. But generally speaking, that is gone. And what has happened is you have these two kinds of groups that remain as targets. First, obviously, African Americans, but I think what we've seen most recently is a real escalation of the anti-Semitism that's characteristic of the today's white nationalist groups.
Do you know, when they collapsed, as you say, in 1926, like the big movement then, what caused that collapse? Like, what made it fall apart?
Okay, this is a very interesting story. In fact, the second Klan was a for-profit corporation. It was registered in Atlanta. That may seem odd, because I think today many people think, well, if you're in a social movement, you should be working to advance what your beliefs are rather than working to make money. But on the other hand, the profit motive is a very, very basic American value, and that was part of what the Klan was about. What they did, and this is was quite a shock to me, I think that this was the first ever social movement to hire a professional PR firm to promote them. And that is why they were able to get this phenomenal start very, very quickly, up to having millions of members. And it happened through it's what I call recruitment by commission. In some ways, it's a pyramid scheme. You had to pay a $10 initiation fee to join the Klan. That is, in today's dollars, would be way over $120. And that's very important, because I think a lot of people like to think of the Klan as an organization of poor and uneducated people, when it was a completely, mainly middle-class operation. But anyway, about the scheme, if I recruit you and you give me $10, I get to keep 40% of that. You can then go and recruit someone else, and you could get 40% of that, and you on and on and on. Eventually, though, like in all pyramid schemes, you run out of people to recruit. You've sort of sat market, so to speak. But certainly that financial business in the first couple of years was partly responsible for this enormous growth. It actually, well, it was a little bit religious in that they used the cross, but actually it's very occult. And for people who really study it, it goes back to sort of medieval, all kinds of things. I have to say that when I first looked at and read the details of these secret codes and secret gestures and secret movements and so on, I thought, well, this is like a 10-year-old boy playing a game. But I also came to understand that I think for a lot of participants, I have often called it a participatory theater. You get to put on this amazing costume. You conduct these rituals in the dark with torches and so on, and it's kind of fun. But on the other hand, I think it got a little bit old hat. And while the Klan had these millions and millions of members, it also had a lot of turnover because a lot of people got bored with it. A lot of people started thinking, look, all this organization is doing is trying to get money out of me. So that was partly what undercut it.
What kind of manufactured stories did they do back then?
They're amazing. And, I thought of them as unusual, although recently I've heard some that could compete in their absurdity. Well, a grandiose conspiracy theory was that the reason these, Italian Catholic and other Catholic immigrants were coming to the United States was not because they were poor, but because the Pope ordered them to come, and once here, they were supposed to be sort of underground, like moles in an espionage novel, and they were to lay low until they received the command to help be the soldiers in a coup that was going to take over Washington and turn this into the United States of Catholic America. So wow. That kind of thing goes on and on. Then there are also smaller little conspiracy allegations. Well, I don't know about small, but other conspiracy allegations. But, I do think that all these groups do have in common fear-mongering. And they also have something else in common, which is characteristic of conspiracy theories, and that is that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to persuade people, to make people doubt them by saying, well, what's the evidence? Where is the evidence for this? Because the answer, quite simply, it's kind of a circular logic, is, well, of course there is no evidence because the conspiracy is secret, and that's why we don't have any evidence. So you create for yourself a kind of a bubble that cannot be penetrated by other people trying to argue with you.
In the 1920s, were they prone to violence? Is that just a minority aspect of everything they're up to?
No, in fact, this is really the genius and the other part of what made the group so both so powerful and so big, and that is that it was mainly nonviolent. There were people at the edges who were doing these things, but especially when the second imperial wizard, as they called him, Hiram Evans, took over, these people were shrewd, and they understood that they could get much further by using electoral means and by using their vast propaganda machine. They operated about 150 print publications, and they also owned two radio stations. They elected 11 governors and something like 65 congressmen, and these are people who either ran openly as Klan members or openly stating that they supported the Klan. So it's a completely nonviolent in its claims. Now, there were, I say, at the edges. I think a lot of young guys particularly get attracted to this, and they're just sort of itching for a fight.
Yeah.
And it wasn't always possible for the central leadership to control that. But this is really important, because I don't think you could have easily 3 to 5 million Americans joining a group that was oriented around violence.
I think a lot of people that are listening, obviously there's a parallel, right, century-wide, because we're in the 20s right now, and with Trump we saw a resurgence. So what, and then you said there were these four different waves, like, so the wave you're writing about in this book, what was it that made it sort of diminish and lose momentum?
Well, it's partly this business of there was so much money flowing around. There was just extraordinary reports of corruption, and after a while, people didn't like that, came to resent that. I mean, for example, the a guy who was the Grand Dragon of the Indiana Klan, which was one of the very, very large clans, used Klan money to buy himself a very luxurious yacht, which he kept on Lake Erie. That kind of thing. But then there were also criminal behaviors. You know, the Klan, like a lot of white Protestants, the Klan was essentially a white Protestant evangelical movement, and its members were supposedly ardent prohibitionists. And when they discussed prohibition and drinking, they, of course, as they did with everything, they sort of racialized it. They claimed that it was only Catholics that drink and only Jews that bootleg or sell the liquor. This is all during prohibition. Now, of course, that's complete nonsense. And what would happen is occasionally these Klan members would be caught drinking. They also were supposed to have this sort of restrictive sexual morality as evangelical Protestants. And then you'd find these cases of these Klan people getting caught with their mistresses or their prostitutes. So, you know, when you have that kind of ideology and you're talking about millions of people, it's pretty hard to make them conform perfectly to what are supposedly the values of the group.
Right. It also seems like the things you're citing with these sorts of hypocrisies are very specific to the values of that point in time. Like, they would be more scandalous then, but they probably, like today with Trump, you know, there's so much he could get away with that would not make his followers break their allegiance to him, even if he's an adulterer or a sex criminal or whatnot. It seems
exactly.
It's just indicative of how the bar was so different at that point that they were existing in a whole other form of hypocrisy.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And here's an interesting development that shows you at least a little bit how thin or how fragile that commitment to these evangelical values. And that is that after the Klan shrank precipitously from millions down to something like 350,000 at the end of the 20s, what you saw is that many Klanspeople went into the American fascist groups that were arising in the 1930s. In the 1930s, we had over 100 fascist groups, and by that, I mean people specifically called themselves fascists and specifically expressed their admiration for Hitler and Mussolini, and some of the groups were very violent and somewhat large. Nothing that leveled that equaled the millions in the Klan, but say one of the big ones called the German American Bund might have had as many as 50,000 people. So I think that one of the things that happened is that the Klan declined as an overall organization. It became harder to control the guys that wanted to be violent.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And I'll just make one comment, if you don't mind, about today's white nationalists, because I think it's parallel. Today we have many, many, many small groups, right?
Yeah.
And that's both a good thing and a bad thing. It's good because there's no national central organization that can really try to pull people together and mobilize them and so on. But it's bad. You don't have a central organization exerting any discipline on what people should and shouldn't do. And right. The fact that the 20s Klan was able to be mainly nonviolent was because it had a big national organization with a strong leadership and standard publications that were insisting on the Klan's principles.
Let's suppose it's the 1920s, and I'm an ordinary person walking around, and I'm being exposed to Ku Klux Klan propaganda. What sort of messaging were they sending out to the public? Like, you did a really great job explaining how they were recruiting and what it was like internally with the fear-mongering, but what are they telling, like, if they're going to, what are they just telling the average person? What are their electoral agendas?
Well, their electoral agenda is extremely focused on the wrong kind of people and immigration restriction. Now, of course, immigration restriction is only a federal law, but in certain areas, they worked to produce local state laws. For example, in the Pacific Northwest, in Oregon and Washington, it was Klan or Klanish people that put through what were called the alien land laws, which prevented, we're talking mainly Japanese or Chinese immigrants, which prevented them from owning land. In some cases, even prevented them from owning businesses. So in some cases, what they're doing is they're trying to get rid of the competition for the, quote, right people, who are the white Protestants. But, you know, I think a really important thing to understand about what drew people to the Klan is I think many of those people were kind of a little bit apolitical. They were probably bigoted, but the Klan was a fraternity, and it appeared at a time when the United States had many, many, many fraternities, most of which were ethnically oriented. You know, you had Irish fraternities and Czech fraternities and German fraternities. And to many people, the Klan was just another one. But it had kind of more exciting things to offer. One of their other just extremely sophisticated propaganda stuff was they conducted these massive outdoor rallies, frequently on July 4th, because they, of course, presented themselves as the real patriots. But these kind of events, they were like county fairs. They had all kinds of rides and contests and food. And in several, there was a very dramatic thing in which the Imperial Wizard would arrive by airplane. At a time when most Americans had never seen an airplane. So this was like, wow, you know, it was high entertainment. And furthermore, like all fraternities, they provide a socialization and bonding. The Klan also had 1.5 million women, and I suspect that their kind of sociability was different, but nevertheless very important. It's a way that people get together with friends and so on to share. So I think it's important to understand that movements like this provide rewards for people that are not just political.
Right. Yeah, there's a social reward. What's also interesting, what's so fascinating about all the things you're sharing is that as the groups get splintered or as the Klan waxes and wanes, the ideas never go away. It's not that I think I would have an idealistic fantasy that, at a certain point they became less relevant because people became less bigoted, but it's simply untrue. It's the waxing and waning seems to be more tied up in the internal politics and the dynamics of the group.
You're absolutely right. And I would add to that, this is a surmise. You know, in the 1920s, there were no national polls. But my guess is that a majority of white Protestants would have agreed with the Klan about Catholics and Jews.
Wow.
At the top of, you know, we had a lot of what are called nativists, who I discuss a little bit in the book, people against immigration. But the nativist movement was a movement of the very rich and the very distinguished. It was filled with Harvard professors and so-called scientists who were into eugenics, and they came up with quote-unquote data. For example, they began to do what they called IQ testing of immigrants that were arriving at Ellis Island, and they concluded, for example, that I may have not have the figures right in my head, but that 70% of Jews are morons, and the Chinese are just...
I'm laughing because I'm Jewish. Go ahead.
Yeah, and the Chinese are ineducable. There's just no way that you can educate the Chinese. And these are people who call themselves scientists and who publish in these journals. You know, and the, another thing about the eugenics, I'm sure you know what that is, about the science of breeding to create a better human stock. Sure. In the 1920s, just about every college biology textbook had a section on eugenics. That was considered, you know, good science.
Wow. It's amazing. The rhetoric has softened. Like, you're not allowed to say these. I mean, I shouldn't jump to conclusions because we have QAnon nowadays that says completely outrageous things. But it seems like in the public sphere, you know, you're not allowed to make these sort of wildly general declarations. But even though the rhetoric has softened, the ideas, these ideas of bigotry are very, very hard to get rid of.
That's true. And here's one connection I would make with what goes on today. You know, when I first started to talk about the Klan, people would say, well, you know, a lot of people are anti-Semitic. They just keep it to themselves.
Yeah.
And to that I would say, well, that's true. But it's also true that it makes a difference when you're shouting those things from the rooftops, so to speak. And I think the main achievement of the Klan was not legislation, but it's actually in some ways one of the main achievements that I see of Donald Trump, which is they normalized racist and bigoted talk. They made it respectable to talk that way in public. And I think there is a difference between when people are whispering this stuff privately to each other, you know, in their living rooms, and when they are announcing it publicly, because when it gets public like that, it is very, very dangerous.
Yeah, it's because I think people want, they're looking for any excuse. You know, if people have certain things that are deficient in their own lives, it's very easy to take it out on another party and say the blame goes over here. Something I'm really curious about with the 1920s is I presume Mexico sounds like it was less of a factor. It's more, in terms of the immigration picture, was more focused on Asian Americans. Is that accurate?
The thing about the immigration restriction is that there was no restriction on immigration from Latin America, and there was an economic reason for that, because by the 1920s, in these huge farms, they're not really farms, they're like plantations, in California, you know, these thousands of acres, the labor force was by that time dominated by either Mexican Americans or Mexican people who were coming across the border, and the big growers were an enormously powerful political lobby, and they did not want any restriction that would affect Mexicans. That's another thing that's typical of the Klan, is that different chapters would respond to the particular conditions in their region. That's why in the Pacific Northwest there was an emphasis on Asians, because that is where Asians were coming. And in California, they were even going out into the fields, and they had a conflict with the growers because their racism made them think that Mexicans shouldn't be in this country, but the big growers wanted them.
Wow. Linda, something I've always been so curious about, and I feel a little embarrassed that I don't know, is I have no idea why they're called the Ku Klux Klan. Like, where does the name come from?
Oh, nobody. There are a lot of theories, but it's actually from certain kinds of medieval stuff. The uniforms and the hoods. You can see that actually, oddly enough, in the Catholic tradition, in these kind of pilgrimages and penitences, particularly in Spain, where people wore these kind of costumes. But the Klan's terminology was actually, I think, playful, and I think people enjoyed it. Every single one of their terms started with KL, right? You have a clay lift, you have a clumbocation, you have a clavern.
Oh, wow.
And it's funny, when I was younger, people on the left were spelling America with three K's instead of a C.
Oh, that's right.
As a kind of critical of America. Well, the Klan did that proudly. there are quite a number of studies that I didn't go into of the sources of these bizarre codes. I mean, for example, they renamed every day of the week. They renamed every month of the year. That was the kind of thing that made me see it as a kind of play acting, and I cannot believe that the average member actually memorized all of these different codes.
Yeah, that's fascinating that it was playful, because from my vantage point, I would presume this is like the least playful, the most self-serious group of people imaginable, but it makes sense because they're socializing. Like you said, there's a level of excitement, they're having fun, so it's almost like there's a certain music in all the caves.
Exactly.
Linda,
and I think the role of women there is very important.
I'll tell us more about the role of women.
All right. Well, it's very interesting, and I think it has a lot in common with women and other conservative movements. Because if you looked at the official view that would be in the papers or what the women would say if you asked them about the role of women, it would be very traditional and conservative. Women are supposed to be mothers and wives and to make their homes beautiful and so on. That's true in a lot of conservative movements, but then you look at what they're doing, and it's quite different. And I think people who study this would say Phyllis Schlafly is a good example of this. First of all, I think they actually started to try to assert their independence against the male clan, which wanted to have the right to appoint who should be the heads of the local women's clans. And many of them put up with that. There's a great story in the book that I love because it's from my hometown. It's Portland, in which some male clan heavy tried to do that. And not only did the women stop him, but at some point they actually fought with him physically and beat him with, they says, rolled up umbrellas.
Well, that's a good story.
Now, the women did do a huge amount of work for the male clan, because every time there was one of these big rallies, it was women who organized the games, women who organized the food. There were clan youth groups, a little bit like Hitler Youth in the 1930s. Wow. And, you know, everything that had to do with children, women were mainly in charge of. I think also that the women were more deeply committed to prohibition than the men. For in a lot of middle class families, it was not considered proper for women to drink at that time, and so it was easier for women to take that position. But I also just think there is a lot of sorority. For example, they established a particular clan ritual for a christening, a clan ritual for a wedding, a clan ritual for a funeral. And these are all, there's one book called the Clan, which is sort of the Bible of the clan, but it mainly is a rule book. It sets out the procedures that you're supposed to use in these various rituals. And I think the women were very, very much behind that kind of stuff.
As a historian, what was it that initially drew you to this topic?
Oh, well, this is the first time and probably the last time I'm ever going to write about a right-wing movement, something that I consider very unpleasant. But
I can imagine.
The book that it was originally part of, which will appear someday, was a book about social movements in the 20th century U.S., in which I was using a case study to look at sort of several of the main social movements that we've seen, some of them like the Montgomery bus boycott or the United Farmers Workers. But in the 1920s, the Klan was far and away the biggest movement. And furthermore, I thought maybe it's not a good idea to have a book about social movements that sort of carries the impression that all social movements are good. And those are the reasons that led me to get into this. It was interesting, but sometimes I have to say I just felt, almost polluted by having to read all this bigotry and racist stuff.
Oh, man, I can imagine.
I think it's really important. As I said at the beginning, I decided I was not going to preach in any way about the present, but I think it is important, and I think people who read it would see the connectives and would begin to consider what is the power of the fear-mongering that makes people feel that diversity is a problem. That was really central to the Klan's idea. Their view was that only a homogeneous population can make a strong country, and that the moment it becomes diverse, it weakens the country's values. I think that is perhaps said more strongly, but I think there are people today who feel that way. And I also see that I would like them to look at conspiracy theories from the past in the hopes that those conspiracy theories will make them think about today's conspiracy theories. But I have to tell you, I have no illusions that this book is going to be widely read by people who would be favorable to Klanish ideas.
Yeah. Hey, so do you have a website, or do you have anything like that, or are you staying away from a social presence?
I did. It's not focused on the book. I do. It's not focused on the book, and it's pretty sort of scholarly. It just lists things. But it is. It's www.lindagordonhistorian.org. And Linda Gordon Historian is one word and all lowercase.
Fantastic. We'll put that up on the website, too, and hopefully it's have you had backlash about the book? Anybody sort of given you a bad time over it?
Yes, not a lot. There were actually two different occasions in which I was giving a talk, one of them, surprisingly enough, right here in New York City, where there were death threats, and I was concerned because it meant that people had felt they had to put guards up, and that's just a mood that I don't like.
Yeah.
I've had some completely ridiculous, I have in my collection, I think, I can't remember if it's a postcard or a letter that says, "How dare you say the Klan was racist?"
Oh my goodness. It's outrageous.
you wonder what planet people are on. But actually, the most interesting thing is that there are people who have documents from their grandparents or further back than that that show you how absolutely normalized the Klan was. I used to teach at the University of Wisconsin, and I'm in the middle of a project that's been developed there because the University of Wisconsin was one of many universities that had a Ku Klux Klan chapter as a registered fraternity. And we are discovering more and more of that. It was true at Harvard as well. So I think that one of the things that I find interesting is just that people send me little tidbits of new material, so to speak.
Hmm. Oh, that's nice.
Pretty amazing. It's amazing that some people would be upset that the KKK is considered racist, because I would think that they would own that. You know, yeah. If it's their belief, it's the primary focus of why they are together. Why not own it? I don't understand that.
Yeah, but there is a certain kind of illiteracy in this country. I don't even know what the person who wrote that meant.
Yeah.
Well,
it's been a pleasure. You know, thank you for coming on the show. The book we're talking about is The Second Coming of the KKK, and we had the guest as the author, Linda Gordon. Thank you.
Thank you for your interest in this. Take care.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end! By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.